Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
And welcome and good morning. I'm Harry Miller.
Good morning. I'm Dave Kubikin.
And Dave and I are two of the attorneys at the Herzog Law Firm, part of the Estate Planning, Medicaid Planning Group. We are here each Saturday morning, the Herzog Law Firm, to talk to you about information that we think might be interesting and important to you, to take your questions primarily about estate planning, asset protection planning, Medicaid planning, wills, trusts, powers of attorney, healthcare proxies, beneficiary designations, estate administration, and we'd love to talk to you here this morning at the studio. You can reach us at 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. Morning, David. How's everything in your world?
Everything's good, Harry. I just realized, I looked at the calendar, today's the 27th of February, which means, if my math is correct, tomorrow's the 28th, which means Monday is March already.
Monday is March, and I don't know, what's the weather like, Ben? Is it going to be in like a lion or in like a lamb?
We're supposed to get some showers on Monday, but temperature's right around 40, so not so bad.
Snow.
Yeah, definitely better. I had about 2 inches in Hoosick Falls this morning when I left the house.
Oh, well. Yeah, well, it's supposed to turn to rain today, right?
Yes, it's supposed to turn to rain.
Not going to do much. You can tell. I mean, there's a break. You can tell when you go outside in the morning and get in the car. There's a break in the bitter cold last week or so. But it was funny. You know, I got to tell you, I took a couple of days off this week, my wife and I went to Cooperstown, stayed a little inn for a couple of nights. I want to tell you, those of you, and I know David is baseball fans, I'll tell you, if you want to have a wonderful day with your family in March.
Oh, Harry, do they have baseball things in Cooperstown? I didn't know. Ben, did you know that?
I had no idea.
Well, I've never been to the Hall of Fame because I'm not as fanatical as Ben or David are about their respective teams. But what a fun, and you know what? Because there's nobody there. It's like the entire Hall of Fame has been set aside for your family, and there's, you know, the guides there and the people that go around, they take all this extra time to explain stuff to you. It's like having your own personal guided tour. There's so many young families here with kids and stuff like that. And, David, your kids would love this. You've probably been there, but there's this one place where you can make a baseball card out of your kids, okay?
Oh, wow.
You put your kids on a baseball card, and you pick their favorite team, which for you I know is the Yankees. And
Whoa.
Ouch. But, boy, that's hurtful. Holy cow.
Sorry.
I believe that David bleeds blue and orange myself.
I don't know. I don't even think Harry went to Cooperstown. I think this is all a setup for a Mets joke.
Anyway, my wife Donna, she, of course, she's only about 4'11". Her favorite, she wanted to be a shortstop.
Wow.
For the Red Sox. She's a shortstop for Red Sox. And then what you do is that they put them on your phone so you can show them to all your friends. You can send them to your friends off your phone. It's really cool.
Harry will be here all week. Oh, I'm sorry. It's Saturday. I guess he's done.
I'm done now. Okay,
that's really cool, Harry. That's great.
Let's talk about estate planning now.
No. So, Harry, I mentioned the calendar. It's kind of important, right? The winter is particularly difficult for a lot of our clients. Just getting around, you feel a little different when it's a lot colder outside. I think the fact that it's going to get warmer slowly, and that even though March is a really long month, you know, we're about to hit March, which means April, right? I'm hoping that along with a lot of people getting shots in arms, we'll have a little bit more normalcy in our lives. I wonder what your thoughts are.
I think I certainly hope so. I think it looks that way. I think I don't think people, especially when I see clients come in. I'm sure you have too, David. Over the last 3-4 weeks, as clients come in and they've actually gotten their first shot, And some of them have gotten their second shots. And believe me, most of our clients are over 65, so they're all been lined up to do this. Some of the depression that we had last March was really, I don't know about you, but last March was really bummer. I mean, we basically had to close down our office for, what, 3 or 4 months, practically, and do everything remotely. There is a sign of spring, of hope, of rebirth, whatever we do in this time of the year.
And a lot more, so, you know, the inside baseball stuff for people out there, right? We happen to have lots of clients. Estate planning is an industry where it's not just a one and done, right? People always need to maintain their estate plans. We're going to talk about why people may update their plans from time to time. But what ends up happening, Harry, is that when, you know, it's winter time or when a client is not around or they don't want or they cannot come to the office, they're holding back all those little changes they want to their documents. We've had a lot of existing clients get back in touch and say, hey, you know what, now I'm finally ready to amend my trust to do X, Y, and Z or whatever. And I think it's part of the fact that knock on wood, the worst is over.
It is, and some people's estate plans are just in a really awful state of disrepair.
Harry,
David,
I'm sorry, didn't mean to break in like that, but we do have a caller. We have Todd, cool. Todd from Del Mar.
Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, gentlemen. My question is this: I'm under Social Security disability, Medicaid, Medicare, and CDPHP. How much money am I allowed to have in my savings account before I got axed?
Well, under Social Security disability or Medicare, you can have as much money as you want. If you're on Medicaid, are you a single individual or are you married?
Single.
I think it's whatever. It's a $15,000. What, $750? Is that's the resource?
They just went up to 15, for community
Medicaid.
Yeah.
Okay.
So $15,900 is the new number for Medicaid. But Harry and I are talking about Medicaid for long-term care needs. If it's Medicaid as a form of health insurance, which doesn't sound like, since you have CDPHP and Medicare. Assuming it's for, you know, quote unquote long term care, then yeah, it's $15,900. It's not in the bank. That's your resources. Resources
for community,
include
for community Medicaid, and you can have a house. You can own
banks.
You can own your house also if you're on community Medicaid, and you can have the $15,000 in addition to that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So let's see. So I could have $15,900 in the bank, but no house.
No, you can own your house if you're on community Medicaid. If you're in a nursing home, your house would be considered an asset. But if you're in community Medicaid, you can own a house, no matter, as long as it's worth less than $850,000, and still receive community Medicaid, which covers it covers anything that Medicare and CDPHP don't cover. Right.
Right.
So, are you actually using the Medicaid at all?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe for prescription drugs?
That too.
Yeah. Okay.
So Todd, the issue I have is when you say you can have $15,900 in the bank, well, it's subject to whatever else you own. Okay, a house could be exempt if you're still living at home and on Medicaid. However, there's other assets you may have that go towards that $15,900. So if you have a CD or savings bonds, if you have
a life account, insurance policy.
If you have life insurance, yeah, that's a big one. Life insurance.
That has cash value. So you've been on this how long? A couple of years?
It's probably been 15 years now.
Correction.
8 years.
All right. But every year you have to recertify your eligibility, right? And tell them what assets you have, right?
Yeah, it's been deferred due to the COVID, but I haven't had to claim anything yet.
Okay. All right. Well, those are the limits.
Yes, okay. you add up all your resources and you make sure they're below $15,900, and keep in mind that for home care, a house is not a resource. For Medicaid purposes, often qualified retirement plans are not going to be resources, and so on. And then you kind of try to stay below that, and every year it'll go up a couple $100, and off you go.
Thanks so much, gentlemen.
No problem.
Okay.
Take care.
You too. Thanks for listening.
So long.
You know, Harry, I forwarded you an article that was in the Times this past week, and you and I both commented on how it's probably a couple hours of discussion if we wanted to. I'd love to get into this, and I think that our obviously callers, please call with anything, whether it's on topic or not. But I'd love to kind of explore this because I don't think we do it very often on the radio. I don't think we do it very often in our seminars or webinars. And the idea is about equal or unequal inheritances to your loved ones. How do you want to leave things to people? And I'll just preview it for a second, Harry. A lot of times people will confuse the words equal with the words equitable. Equal means everyone
gets not equitable. And David, years ago, used to do some matrimonial stuff. And New York is not an equal distribution state, is it? It's an equitable. No. And fair isn't always equal. Yeah, right. Okay.
So equal may be equitable, but it's not always. And the reasons why clients may decide that in their estate planning documents, their will or their trust, they're going to leave one child more than the other, leave a child out, have different percentages of beneficiaries. There's a couple of different scenarios that this article goes through. So, Harry, I'd like to talk about it, if you don't mind.
Sure. Me? Yeah, absolutely. It reminds me, actually, we were doing sports. You know, sports earlier, the top of the hour. There's an old adage in sports was attributed, I think, Haywood Hale Bruin or John Rutan, that sports does not build character; it reveals it. And the same is true. The same is true of parental inheritance in many ways. You will really find out who your brothers and sisters are. When as my mother used to say, when the chest is opened, everyone will be there.
Right.
And the reason we want to talk about this is because very often people don't get the best kind of advice, or they go ahead and do it themselves, and they don't understand the potential ramifications of giving one kid the house, one kid a brokerage account, one kid an insurance policy. You know, there are different children who have needs, financial needs, and other types of needs. And some of them are good reasons to do things, and some of them are really terrible reasons to do things, and that's what, you know. So how do you want to kick this off, Dave?
Well, so let's start with the idea that if you don't have a plan, Harry, okay, New York has a statute that says how your assets are going to go, and it treats your children equally, okay?
Yes.
One child is no different than the other. An adopted child is the same as a whole blood child, et cetera, et cetera, okay?
Yes.
But that's the default, right? You don't have a plan. Everyone's going to get the same. And that becomes an issue because when you do go away from giving everyone the same amount of money, Harry, we know that in on the back end, in terms of will there be a potential fight, the people who could fight, right, are the people who would get more money if there was not a will,
correct,
as an example. So, Harry, if you're my child, this is weird. Maybe we should go the other way. Harry, you're my child.
Hey, Dad.
And I decide, despite the fact you're my child and my only child, I want to give everything to Ben. Okay, I do a will that leaves everything to Ben. You absolutely, Harry, have the right to contest my will, because if there was no will, say you get everything.
I get it all. And Ben, you know, and I would probably be wondering what Ben did to inveigle you to give him all of your estate. It's called undue influence, right?
Mm. Well, at least he knows what kind of sports fan I am, Harry Miller.
Oh, yeah. No doubt about that.
Well, no, you're not a Yankees fan, that's for sure. Okay.
So Harry, there are reasons why people will want to leave their kids different amounts, and
right,
usually it's not for lack of love or affection or anything like that. There was a survey that Merrill Lynch had done where two-thirds of those 55 and over, said that if you have a child of yours who is providing you care in your later years, they should get more money than children who perhaps are not. And it may be all local kids. It may be, well, your son would love to provide care. He lives in Seattle, Washington. How is he going to provide you care? But
right,
the idea is, do you give a reward to someone who is providing care to you?
Well, I'm finding that in clients that I see, particularly in the last 2 to 3 years, clients who are relying on one child as opposed to other children, and there are various reasons for that. As you said, geography is an important one. Relationships is something else. Frequently want to confer a greater benefit on the caretaker child. In and of itself, that doesn't sound like a bad idea. I think with all of these things, what's bad about the idea is when parents go ahead and do that and they don't announce it, they don't have a family meeting and tell the other children what they're doing, why they're doing it, because in the absence of that, mom is going to be dead, and now we're going to find out that Susie, who's, you know, she took care of mom, so she's getting the house, and the other two kids are getting a lot less. All right, well, that's fine. If everybody was aware of it and they thought it was okay, or even if they didn't think it was okay, they understood it was mom's decision, and that sort of eliminates a claim of undue influence by Susie, you know. And the other girl might have said, well, yeah, Susie saw a good deal. She might have been with mom, quit her job, and, you know, and she's been taking care of her 3 years, but I noticed she's also been paying her own bills out of mom's checking account. That doesn't fly so well either. So, all these things potentially are tinged with collateral damage issues that can really muddy up the water.
Right, and to be clear, Harry, you're not saying never should you give a caregiving child more money than a non-giving caregiving child. It's just there's some thought that needs to go into it. It's their choice at the end of the day, but there are these unintended consequences, right, for sure.
Yeah.
Another version of it is where people will, you know, reflect in their will and their trust that I'm leaving more to Harry than I am to Ben, because during Ben's life, right, during my life, you know, I paid for Ben's, you know, Ben went to dental school, Harry did not. Harry went, you know, I paid for a lot more of Ben's needs during my life, thus I'm going to try to equalize this out a little bit.
Right. Yeah, I have a lot of clients who do that. I have a client who they had three children. I think they gave each two of the daughters, they each gave them maybe $30,000 or $40,000 toward a down payment on the house. All right, and the third kid didn't. I don't know. I think maybe didn't need the help, or what, for whatever reason didn't get $30,000, but at the time of death, they wanted to equalize the three kids. So they just kind of gave them $30,000 off the top, all right, and then split everything else three ways. It could do the same if you had three kids and two of them went to college and one of them didn't. I mean, now it's an issue with college education. I mean, when I went to college, you know, it was so cheap, it really it didn't cost very much money to go to college in the 1960s. But now you're looking at what, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year of tuition. You could be dumping $200,000, $250,000 on a child's education. That's a chunk of change.
I think you're even low on the cost of college, Harry, to be honest with you. I heard some very scary.
When I went to school, I think it was $2,800 a year. So multiply that by four. Today, it'd be I think the same college is in the 60s. You know, so yeah, it's huge.
So Harry, the reason people equalize is because they feel that their desire is to make things actually literally equal, right? And that's not something anyone needs to do. You may choose to do that. I mean, I'm thinking here, someone is going to say, hey, you know what? Harry's right. I'm going to start writing down when I'm paying for stuff for kids. I don't think I'll ever go that far personally, right? It's just, in general, big, big, big outlays, you know.
Right.
The article mentions, you know, a child who lost their job during the pandemic, and the, you know, mom and dad are really changing their estate plan to favor that child because of the current and expected financial needs. And you know, that brings up something we always talk about, which is you actually never know how your kids are doing financially. Unless you're looking at their statements and you know what loan is associated with that nice car they have, or what mortgage is associated with that big old house they have, you really don't know their finances. So
you bet you don't. There's an old country and western song called "Just because you drive a fancy car don't mean you're rich." and it's true. Some people have extravagant lifestyles and actually zero money in the bank, and so you don't really know except by these impressions, unless you're very close. Most children don't share their financial information with their parents, I don't think, at least not that I see very often. And that's the hardest thing, I think. Having a child, if you have a child who has a disability and is going to need some long-term help, that's kind of a no-brainer. If we want to set aside extra money to care for a child who really is physically or emotionally in need of care, that's different. But when we get around to rewarding bad behavior, you know, giving more money to the ne'er-do-well child as opposed to your daughter who finished medical school and your son who did a startup IT company and now is worth, you know, $10 million or whatever it happens to be. And then there's a third kid who just, you know, kind of didn't have a lot of ambition, didn't do well in school, didn't, you know, just kind of dragged his feet from job to job to job. I think that's the toughest call for parents, and many parents have kids that fit those categories. The only thing I would say, if you're going to leave extra money, or even the same amount of money, perhaps, even if you're treating them equally, to the kid who's just kind of shuffled through life and didn't achieve much, I think you would look at why that was, if you can. But for heaven's sakes, think about putting the money in a trust of some kind, all right, rather than just dumping it in their lap, because it's likely to go the route of whatever else they did during the course of their lives. And these are tough, they're tough issues for parents to come to grips with when you take a long, hard look at your kids as adults and see where they are, what they've become, and what kind of needs they may have going forward after you're not here anymore.
Sure. And, you know, Harry, okay, fine. You know what? I'm going to make it easy. This is a headache. I'm just going to leave everything equally to my kids, right? Sure, that's a way to go, but you may be not doing what you really wanted. You can have your cake and eat it too in our profession. You are able to get exactly what you want. I mean, with very, very few exceptions, Harry, if a client comes in and says to you, I want this, this, and this, in terms of where my money goes, I mean, I don't want to downplay our job, but it's words on a piece of paper. We could do it. We could figure that out. But when they're not here anymore, and one of the siblings calls our office and says, I can't believe, blah, 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 there's no way my mom would have ever wanted that, and I want to fight this thing, well, then we're spending some money. Right, then you know, we've been on all ends of it. We have litigations where we represent children who are not happy with what happened, rightfully so or wrongfully so, or they think that one of their siblings kind of snuck in there and got some changes made that really weren't the intention of mom or dad.
Right.
We've defended, right, mom and dad, or their estates, rather, in terms of what their plans were. And I kind of want to get into this part of it, which is really inside baseball. I tend to be heavy on notes, but less heavy on writing reasons for the plan in the actual documents. So what I'm saying for everyone else out there is I'm not going to say I'm leaving less to Ben because Ben stole cookies from the cookie jar, you know, 40 years ago. I may say for reasons known to me, but I've told my attorney, and my attorney has notes that say, well, we're really not happy with Ben for a couple reasons.
I never put a reason. I never put any reason or no reason or anything. But what I do, when I leave unequal amounts of money to family members, I almost always, unless a client insists otherwise, and I try to talk them out of it, I put a provision in that says I have knowingly and intentionally made unequal distributions of my assets to my children, period. Because if you put a reason there, for reasons best known to forget the reason. You don't need a reason. You don't need a reason to disinherit or leave more or less money to your children. That suggests, and for heaven's sakes, if you put the wrong reason, if you put a reason in there it's not a right reason, now you really got a will contest on your hands.
Right, and to put some color on that, if I leave less to Ben because he took cookies from the cookie jar, in, you know, 1983, if somehow is able to prove he didn't, right? Now the court's going to say, oh, right, Dave was under this misunderstood presumption that something happened, and Ben said Dave's got his capacity, sure, but he was wrong on this fact, and that's never the situation we want to be in.
Well, it begs a lawsuit. It really does. I mean, for instance, I've had clients over the years, not a lot, but I have clients who have a child, a son or a daughter, who's just literally a spendthrift. And if they inherited $250,000 from mom or dad, it'd be blown in a year, okay? I've had clients, for instance, who have bypassed the child who has the spendthrift, largely. They left him or her a little bit. And I have a client say, look, she has two kids who are really smart, and I want to make sure those kids get a college education. So instead of leaving it to the spendthrift daughter, they put it in an educational trust, her share or some of it or most of it, in an educational trust for the grandchildren, the children of that daughter, because the client wanted to make darn sure those kids got through college, and she knew if her daughter inherited the money, she'd just spend it, and there wouldn't be anything left for college tuition. I mean, these are the kinds of things you got to look at when you take a long, hard look at your family. And I think what happens here is, and these things happen, when you come to the Herzog Law Firm and you, we're running up on time or something, or no?
Okay.
When you come to our firm, we have such breadth. We have so much experience in these areas. We've been doing this for a long, long time. That there are very few family configurations and dynamics that we haven't experienced at one point or another. And we can really help you talk you through the options and what makes the best sense and what doesn't make the best. So you can make a really intelligent decision. You're ultimately the one that's going to decide what you do, not us. But before you make a decision that might result in a will contest or worse than that, your children never speak to each other again after you die. I mean, we don't want to destroy the family relationship. That's the whole part of this is to preserve unity and harmony in the family. But that doesn't necessarily mean that equal is always the best way. Equal is the easiest way, but it may not be the best way for your family.
Harry and David, we do have a caller, but we're close to the bottom of the hour, so we're going to take our break right here. We'll be right back with the second half of the Herzog Law Firm's Estate Medicaid Planning Hour coming up right after this.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for,
options available for Medicaid planning, and more.
With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany,
West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs,
Executive Woods in Clifton Park,
and Flatbush Road in Kingston.
Our attorneys are here to help you.
If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David,
Jane Marie Harry, or Debbie,
please call us during normal business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581.
Our Saratoga Springs office at 518-581-8131.
Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010.
And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405.
Let the Herzog Law Firm help you navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
And welcome back to the Herzog Law Firm's Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour. I'm Harry Miller.
Good morning. I'm Dave Kubikin.
And we are with the Herzog Law Firm as we're here each Saturday morning to talk to you, answer your questions. And I think from what Ben tells me, we have a caller on the line, Patrick from Troy. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. A question for you. You helped me several years ago when my mom had to go into a nursing home, and at that point I found out that an IRA was a protected asset not to be drawn down by the government if she applied for Medicare.
Down to some extent, but you don't have to entirely liquidate it. Yes, go ahead. Yeah, sure.
Okay. All right. So my question now applies to myself. I have a deferred compensation 457 plan.
Uh-huh.
That I have some money in from working in
through the state.
Yes. Is that a protected asset in the same way?
Yes. It is treated just like an IRA. Yes?
Go ahead.
Yeah, if it, whether it's an IRA or a 401k plan or a 457 or a 403b, all those numbers are just sections of the Internal Revenue Code. All right, Section 403. Your retirement plan comes under Section 457 of the Internal Revenue Code, which is a retirement plan for people who work in government. Okay, and the other is if you work in nonprofit, if you worked at RPI in the educational, and if you work in private business, you're going to have either an IRA or a 401k. They all work the same way, pretty much. When you hit 72, you're going to have to start taking money out of there, whether you want to or not. If you go into a nursing home, whatever's in there is a non-countable resource, but you have to start taking periodic distributions in order for the government not to count it. All right?
Gotcha. Okay.
So, right, now, and go ahead.
Another question related to that. I can, I'm at this point, I'm 59, so I can go into the, I could get money out of my deferred comp at any time when I retired from my law enforcement. An IRA, you have to be 59 and a half. So my question, I'm 59 and a half. My spouse is several years younger than me. If we convert to an IRA and I pass away at, say, 62 and she's in her early 50s, you can't get into an IRA until you're 59 and a half. Is her ability to access that IRA based upon my age if she's the beneficiary, or would it be based upon her age if I'm deceased and she's now the beneficiary of that account?
So, Patrick, the IRA she would have would be something she inherited.
Right.
So the rules are a little different when it's an inherited IRA. At some point, you know, the government wants to get some money here. They want to get some taxes from distributions that you're taking, required distributions at 72, or voluntary distributions you're taking 59 and a half and up. But what they're doing these days when it's an inherited IRA is that they're saying, okay, this is now in distribution status, and there will be distributions made now. I think your question is, can they make you take it, or you're saying, could she take it? She may want to take it, even though she's younger. Is that what you're saying?
Right. I can, if it's converted to an IRA at 59 and a half, I can take money out of it and just be taxed without penalty. But my,
if you're 59, there's no tax. There's a tax penalty to you.
No, not a tax. Okay, but I mean, but if she's not 59 and a half, and she becomes a beneficiary if I'm deceased, does...
Well, if it's an inherited IRA, I think she's going to have to start taking distributions a year following your death, no matter what age she is.
Okay, but I was saying if she's less than 59 and a half, because she's now the owner of that asset, could she take money out of that penalty free, just pay the tax?
I think so. Yes. You are. Yeah. I mean, I just had a client who died recently who had an IRA, and it's inherited by her two children, both of whom are in their 50s, their early 50s, okay?
Right.
Now, it's not a spouse, it's a child. Now, this next year, she died in 2021, so they don't have to take it this year. This year, the year their mother died, they have to take out her RMD for the tax year 2021. Last year, there was an RMD deferral because of the virus. In 2021, there's no more RMD deferral. You're going to have to take your RMD sometime this year. They had to take their mother's RMD and split it between the two of them. Now, in 2022, they're going to have to take their RMD out. Now, the only difference is if your spouse rolls it into her name and takes distributions, she can use her life expectancy. So if she's only 58, she has probably at least a 20-year life, 20-25-year life expectancy. Now, the children of my client who died can no longer use their life expectancy for distribution purposes, even though they're only 52 and probably have a life expectancy of close to 30 years. The government last year passed an amendment to the IRA and the 457 rules. Those kids have to take that money out within 10 years of the mother's death. So they can't use their life expectancy anymore unless you're a spouse, in which case you can.
Gotcha. Okay.
That's complicated rules.
Thanks for listening. It's the rules on IRAs have just gotten so astonishingly complex because there's, you know, as with every rule of law, there's a dozen exceptions. So you have to take it out over 10 years, you know, unless you're a minor child, unless you're disabled, unless certain other things happen. So if you, IRAs are becoming very complex. And the nasty thing about IRAs, and this brings me back to what Dave and I were talking about before the break, IRAs are poisoned with income tax consequences. And one of the things, you know, we were talking about in this Times article that Dave was talking about is, you know, if you leave your $200,000 IRA to your son, and you leave your $200,000 brokerage account to your daughter, that's a really dumb idea for most of the time, okay? Because your son is inheriting a $200,000 asset.
Well, Harry,
income taxes on, right?
Yeah, Harry. Let's just say this part to it. If you think that a $200,000 IRA and a $200,000 brokerage account at death is the same amount of money, you're incorrect. So if your intention is to leave your son about $140,000, right, then you could leave him your $200,000 IRA. If your intention is to leave him to a $200,000 asset, just like the one you're giving your daughter, then that is not actually equal, as Harry just mentioned. So the tax
because the brokerage account. Go ahead. The brokerage account. When you die, the stocks in your brokerage account get a new cost basis as of the date of your death. So if your daughter liquidates that account, she's not going to pay any taxes, all right? No capital gains taxes. Whereas if your son's in a 25 or 28% tax bracket, 25, 30% of the IRA is going to go back to the government in taxes.
Harry, David, we have another caller. We have Leo in East Greenbush.
Hey, Leo. Morning, Leo.
Hi, good morning. Nice program. I have an easy question for you that's difficult for me. Would you comment on the advisability of moving an annuity into a revocable trust for the purpose of protecting or attempting to protect the income from the annuity from the long-term care costs, which are probably sometime in the future. The purpose would be to continue the current monthly income from the annuity, which could be used towards the costs, or may not. If you'd comment on that, please.
Sure.
I'm going to hang up now.
Okay, thank you, Leo.
Yeah.
So it's one of the things that Harry had mentioned when he was talking about the IRAs before with Patrick and the you know different kinds of qualified retirement plans is the idea that Medicaid, right, we're worried about long-term care, we're worried about qualifying for Medicaid. Medicaid looks at assets as one of two things. It's either going to be a resource or it's going to be a stream of income. And there's asset rules, that's the 15,900 we were talking about before, subject to, you know what if you have a spouse or not, and so on and so forth. And then there are income rules. And when we do a trust, and you mentioned revocable trust, just to reiterate, the kind of trust that would be helpful for long-term care planning is not revocable. It's a Medicaid asset protection trust, which is technically irrevocable. But putting that aside for a second, I think I know what you meant. That trust that we do most often, you are still the income beneficiary of that trust, okay? That's for a number of reasons. First of all, we have plenty of good life that we want to be able to have money for. We want to use and enjoy our assets. But another reason, a hidden reason, is when Harry talks about that, quote-unquote, step up in the tax basis, right, when we have a brokerage account that's inherited, as an example, it's all because you still get to use and enjoy the income. Why am I saying all this before answering your question? Well, you're talking about preserving income, and that's not something a trust can accomplish because we want you to still be the income beneficiary now, and there are separate income rules that Medicaid employs that doesn't keep you from qualifying, but just subjects your income to a spend down. It gets one more step complicated, Leo, which is if we're talking about nursing homes, our options are a little more limited than if we're talking about home care. And that's why, you know, if it feels like when you listen, we keep saying home care, home care, home care, it's because not just is it your home where you're probably most comfortable, but we actually, through some rather complicated planning, can protect your income in the moment when it comes to home care. So that's my long answer to a very simple question. Harry, what are your thoughts?
Well, two things. I thought Leo said a revocable trust. A revocable trust, putting an annuity in a revocable trust will not protect it from nursing homes or any other assets that are in it. You have to do an asset protection trust, okay? And then the question is, do you want to move the annuity to from your individual ownership to the trust? Because all we can do, annuities are odd creatures that very few people understand completely, and I don't claim to either, but I probably know a little more than many people do. In an annuity, there are three people involved. There is the owner of the annuity, the person who bought it from the insurance company, and I'm talking about non-qualified annuities here, not a qualified annuity, which would be part of a retirement plan that would be treated like the 457 plan the last caller was with the deferred comp thing. This is a non-qualified annuity, so you give the insurance company $100,000 and you buy an annuity, and they promise to pay you at some point some money for the rest of your life, all right, at some point. You have different options you can select. There's the owner. There is the beneficiary. That's who gets whatever is left in the annuity when you die. It's going to probably be your spouse or your children. And then there's this other person called the annuitant. The annuitant is the measuring life for purposes of paying out the annuity money, and that's usually you, all right? So if we change the ownership from you to this Medicaid trust, now the trust owns the annuity, and it has to be a grantor trust, all right? If it's not a grantor trust, you're going to trigger some unfavorable tax consequences. But if it's grantor trust, and our Medicaid trusts are for income tax purposes, we can change the owner to the annuity. But guess what? You're still the annuitant, all right? We can't change the annuitant after you purchase the annuity policy. So even if your annuity is in the trust, and you go in a nursing home, you're still going to have to start annuitizing the annuity, okay, because a person who is in a nursing home and Medicaid has to maximize income, and this is income to you, all right? So why would we bother putting it in a trust? I'll tell you why, because under certain circumstances, what we could do if we want to get rid of the income, we could liquidate the annuity. The trust could sell the annuity, convert it to cash. Guess what? There's no more income stream because the income's going to come. All the money's going to come into the trust. Now, that can trigger some tax consequences, all right, because the buildup in the annuity is taxed as ordinary income. But what it will do is it will shut off the income stream to the nursing home of your annuity payments, which would be, you know, $1,000, a couple $1,000 a month. It may be cheaper to pay the tax than to keep paying the nursing home. That's the advantage of putting it in a trust.
Wonderful caller. Right.
Cool. Harry, we do have some webinars coming up. We do every single week, actually, but on Wednesdays at 10 a.m. at 2 p.m. This week, we have two of our more popular webinars that we do in general. And again, that's this coming March 3rd. At 10 a.m., we have a Wills versus Trusts webinar. And at 2 p.m., it's about aging in place. Wills versus Trust, as you would imagine, talks about the differences and similarities between those two really important documents, as well as the different kinds of trusts and wills that are out there and why you may want to employ one or the other. Aging in place is all about getting that care at home or wherever you call home when we do have those long-term care needs later on in life. It's going to talk about what it means to get those kinds of services and what options there are, as well as how to qualify and protect the income we were just talking about. If you'd like to register for one of the webinars, you can go to our website at www.herzoglaw.com. Go to our seminar tab. You can email us at info@herzoglaw.com. You can call us as well as for a free consult at 518-465-7581. And you can be, I think, our fourth caller or so by calling 476-5900.
Harry, in that article we were talking about, if we could circle back to that, we're almost done with it.
I don't know about that, but go ahead.
Well, one of the survey questions was about, do you treat your children, who have children of their own, differently than your children that do not have a family that they've set up yet? Certainly, I guess life may cost, arguably life costs more for someone without, with children compared to without, or there may be, you know, future costs like college and so on that you may want to make sure that you as a grandparent are paying for.
Uh-huh.
There's no right or wrong on any of this, just like any of those other things, but it's a consideration that people will have. The article Harry mentions that a client of an attorney that wanted to leave more to those children who have children of their own because, among other things, they want to pay for the education for their grandchildren, and similarly, you know, the patriarch of the family, this client's mother, father, had done the same for their children, or rather grandchildren. So the idea is to keep this tradition alive, but the real consequences were there was a pretty big difference in what, you know, the client's children were receiving. Those with kids got more, those without kids got less. Without explanation, without discussion, without some communication, Harry, it gets really, really, really messy.
Well, all these things we've been talking about get really messy without communication. Most estate planning does. I'm not a big proponent of differentiating inheritance based on how many children your kids have, but I don't. That's hard for me to understand. But that's just neither here nor there.
Harry, David,
there are people. Yeah, sure.
I need to jump in here. I'd like to communicate as well. We have Sarah from Albany on the line.
Oh, hi.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to ask a question about the irrevocable trusts that are set up by your law firm.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so number one, is there a minimum amount of time you need to keep the trust open for and a minimum amount of money that needs to be in there? And the third question would be, can I see it's in there a while and I say, well, I want to put it in an IRA? Is that possible? And this is all keeping in mind that I want to stay Medicaid.
Okay. Harry, you want to take
that? I guess the question is, I mean, there's no minimum amount of time that your trust has to be in effect before it's legally a trust. The time period relates to when you set up the trust and fund it with an asset. That could be a house, a bank account, a stock, a bond, an insurance policy. From the time you fund the trust, as a general proposition, 5 years has to come and go before you could apply for Medicaid for nursing home purposes and not have that transfer to the trust counted and result in some penalty for nursing home Medicaid, okay? For instance, there's no minimum amount of money that you would have to put in. If you have a house, it would be worthwhile to set up one of these trusts, perhaps, to protect the equity value of your home, even if you don't have a lot of other financial assets. Now, the same is not true for community Medicaid currently.
That's what I'm more looking towards. I'm getting an inheritance, and I wanted to put that in the trust.
Well, you can't. Right now, we have a small window, at least through, and possibly through the end of 2021, at least through, what is it currently? It's September or something. We have a window of time right now until July 1st, and possibly for the last half of the year, although that's somewhat less certain. Where you, if you're looking for community Medicaid to pay for home care, you could take that inheritance in March, put it into an asset protection trust, and apply for home care in April. There's no penalty currently. There is a penalty on the horizon, but it has currently been deferred by the health department only because of the coronavirus. Because the federal government has certain emergency regulations in effect that preclude the state from beginning to assess a penalty for home care, even though that law has gone into effect. It went into effect last October 1st, but it cannot currently be implemented. So folks out there who need home care, if you've got a parent who needs home care, an aunt or an uncle,
jump on the bandwagon now, because it's not gonna last forever. And we can get that parent, if you have excess resources, we can put them into a trust and get that person qualified for home care in the next couple of months.
Could that ever turn into, like, can you ever take some of that out and into put it into an IRA and still be qualified for Medicaid in the community one, not the nursing home?
Well, that might be difficult once you're on Medicaid to take money out, because anything you take out and put back into your name is going to be treated as income in the month received and later as a resource. So to take money out of a trust to put it in IRA probably wouldn't make any sense under most circumstances. If you have a trust and you're not currently on Medicaid, the assets in the trust can, under certain circumstances, the trust can be partially revoked, and some of the assets can be moved out of the trust back into your name. All right. It becomes more difficult and complicated to do that if you're already on Medicaid.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. Take care. Have a good weekend. It's critically important, if you don't understand this stuff, about the community Medicaid program is still alive and well, and we have this, what is it, March, we were talking March, April, you know, we have at least, March, April, May, we have at least 4 months and maybe 10 months remaining in the year during which we can get your family members some home care services through the Medicaid system, through the community Medicaid system. And the application process is less complicated than the nursing home situation, because we don't have to go back and give them 5 years of financial information about you, because there is currently the look back. There is a look back coming in, but it has currently been suspended because of the COVID virus. But as things get better, as things improve, these regulations are going to be, you know, withdrawn, or they're going to lapse. And so it's a short window of opportunity here that you all ought to be aware of.
It's a reprieve, Harry. You know, the old date was this past October 1st, and those who listen to us frequently know we were talking about October 1st, 2020, with some vigor, and saying get ahead of it. And thankfully, those that did not still are able to do it now. When it does go into effect, Harry, when they do start to ask for 2.5 years of documents, they really will likely go back to that October 1st date based on their current guidance. We'll see how that guidance changes. Mm-hmm. But that means that, if you create a trust today, you put things into the trust today, it still may be subject to a look-back period. The real opportunity, you always want to get the clock ticking, so I don't want to say that it's not an opportunity to get a trust created, but for those who actually have a need, a little bit of a need, a large amount of a need, cognitive issues, just got diagnosed with something awful, you kind of want to get ahead of this. You do not want to apply after this effective date of the look-back period. It's going to be messy. In addition, Harry, to making it financially more difficult to qualify, they're making it, from a needs standpoint, more difficult to qualify. There'll be more activities of daily living that you need help with if you're not someone who has cognitive impairment. That, you know, I think it's a short-sighted thing that New York did. I think it may have been more financially beneficial to them the nursing home look back a year or two, they could have increased, because I say short-sighted, Harry, because you want people to stay at home if you're in New York. You want people to get care when they need it so they don't fall and then have no choice and then need a nursing home. And by making it harder for people to qualify for home care, I think you're going to make it more frequent that people need nursing home care eventually.
Yeah, I frankly don't understand the whole concept of the state in the look back period, because I don't care what you say, it's still cheaper to take care of people at home than in a nursing home under the Medicaid system. It's always been cheaper, it's still cheaper, and it's always going to be cheaper to keep them at home, even people who need 10, 12, 14 hours a day. I mean, But we're not, David and I aren't policymakers. We're just lawyers who understand the mechanics of the system, the eligibility requirements, and right now we can help you get. Right now, we can get you help that you need for your family. On the other hand, if you don't have a current need for help, there's no reason not to set up a trust now and start putting assets in it, because you're not going to be any worse off doing that now than you would be if you waited until after the look-back goes into effect. In fact, you'll be six months or 8 months or a year ahead of the game. So all those things... all those things being equal, the program's still out there and is looking pretty good.
Right.
So what do we have? Did you tell us about the webinars coming up this Wednesday?
Yeah, so we have a regular webinar Wednesday where at 10 a.m. we'll be doing wills versus trust, 2 p.m., aging in place. So you know, for our last caller, a lot of information about home care, a program that she seemed to be interested in qualifying for. For some of our previous callers, the wills versus trust can answer some of those trust questions. What's the right kind of trust? What could I put in? When it comes to an annuity, what do we do with that? Do we use a trust? Do we not? The last itty-bitty part here, Harry, I know we got only a couple minutes. I'm going to push you on this, though. We have a lot of clients who are in second relationships and have kids from prior relationships.
And yeah, we just spent a whole hour doing that. Yes, you're right.
Well, sometimes you have kids... from a earlier relationship and your partner has kids from a previous relationship, and that's when I kind of flip the switch and I say, you know what, in a lot of situations wills are just fine. I always say to people, you know, if you want to create certainty, those mixed situations really require a trust.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, first of all, there are so many more second marriages than there were 25 years ago. There's many more relationships that result in that, and it complicates estate planning, as you said, with stepchildren, and we'll have to defer that, I guess, until the next time you and I are together. But everybody have a great weekend. Enjoy the end of February, and we will talk to you next Saturday. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.